So, Amy Hornblass is with me, and you produced this mask study
Yes.
just in time for not having to wear masks anymore.
Well, with qualifiers, there are still a lot of people having to wear masks. Children, people in hospitals, anybody going for medical care, treatment. Certain professions, workers, employers are still being required. If people can't get the vaccine or don't get the vaccine, there are still lots of people being required to wear them. And they are the most vulnerable ones. So, I know that that announcement came out just as I was wrapping up my writing. It was like literally a week. I was 2 weeks into putting this document together, compiling it, doing the writing. Still had a week to go. And I thought, do I switch? Do I change? Do I sigh of relief and throw it away? And then I realized, no, it's actually more relevant now than ever because now it's going to be used in that way that I described in the report. So anyway, we can get into that. So it's actually, I think, more relevant now than ever.
They're forewarning us of impending future pandemics, which will undoubtedly mandate the use of masks again. Let's talk about what you've learned from the results of the masks survey and the implications of it.
Yeah, so if you don't mind, I'd like to start with why I wrote it.
Okay.
Sort of, a way of connecting with people so that they can understand where this came from. So last year, as we went into the summer, we had shut down the schools and things, and I was just about to start my 11th year in the St. Johnsbury School District as the health educator. I'd been there for 10 years, and I had what I felt like was my dream job. And I've had several dream jobs in my life. I'm very fortunate this way, but this one was the most dream job I've ever had. It took 10 years of working there to work my way up to a full teacher's pay because I came in the back door. I did not get my teacher's license, my educator's license at Goddard College. I studied community health instead. And so I've actually come into teaching health in the public schools through the back door. I gained a lot of experience working in several healthcare environments and other places, including food service, and I'm a certified, person. So I know a lot about viruses and bacteria. I've also spent a lot of time with trauma, working with victims of trauma, and so stress and relaxation, body work, massage therapist. I have all of these other, credentials and experience. I've worked with elders and people with disabilities. So when I, got my health educator's license, it was based on all of that experience, as well as teaching kids in the schools and running teen groups and things and kids groups. So, it took me a while to have full teacher's pay and full teacher's benefits. I finally had a classroom. Believe it or not, that took a while. That took a few years. And I've taught in, three different schools in the area, Cabot School, Northfield Elementary School, and St. Johnsbury School and St. Johnsbury Academy over the course of those 10 years. So it took a while to get established. And I had a kitchen in my classroom that they had just built for me, I like to say, but, a couple of years before. They had just built a kitchen in my classroom so that I could do cooking with the kids, which I was already doing, but, having a kitchen really helps, an official kitchen. And I was near the garden, and I coordinated the school garden. I've been a farm school coordinator here at Cabot School, and I was active in the St. Johnsbury program there. So I've been trained on the farm to plate, that garden to plate cycle. And the kids, it was so much fun. We would do a cooking, we would start seeds, we'd plant them in the garden, bring them up, cook them. I mean, I was living the dream. I had all the students from sometimes preschool, but usually kindergarten through eighth grade. So I was able to develop my curriculum to go from kindergarten to eighth grade so that we could ease into the more sensitive subjects and really cover, all the sensitive issues that health brings up, including death and dying and viruses and puberty and reproduction. So, I really loved my job, and I really loved all 700 of my students who I got to see every year, in health class.
This sounds totally amazing.
It was.
Did you create this yourself? Did this exist before, this particular curriculum?
No, this is what I've had to do in the four schools I worked in. Well, the academy had half of a curriculum, and then I developed the other half. So I've had to, create these curricula for different schools and for different settings, because Northfield Elementary is a different type of community. They didn't want puberty introduced until, a certain grade level. Where Cabot was a little bit different too, and the kids in these different areas had different life experience already too, you know, all kinds of things, drugs and violence, you know, whatever was going on in that community, you know, tobacco use, I could adapt, and I continue to adapt, and I love writing curricula, and I love the way I was able to stack it. And, you know, in sixth grade, I could refer back. Remember in fourth grade when we learned about viruses? And we could talk about it, you know, in that context. And, yeah, I loved it. It was great. And I developed it all. And I love doing that kind of thing. So I'm very good at, and I'm an evidence-based health educator. So what that means is, and we all have to be in the state, that means we have to rely on the evidence. We have to teach to the evidence. And so I also have taken a number of courses over the years on looking at evidence and examining evidence and weighing it and doing literature reviews, you know, on nutrition and things like that. Because there's a lot of disagreeing information out there in the world, you know. Science is not a set answer. You know, it's a process. It's a process of thinking rationally and looking at the data and being able to weigh it against each other and make sense of it and look at the big picture and say, well, you know, if viruses, for example, have always behaved this way, and then we have this one not very credible paper that was written retrospectively on an event that happened that says the opposite, you know, how does that weigh against the preponderance of evidence that says that's not how nature behaves? You know, we would have to change our whole design of nature to make this one conclusion in this one paper make sense. And that's what frightens me, is what started to happen with this mask thing was just that exactly, turning it on its head, turning all of what we know about biology and nature on its head. So last summer, I was, you know, on pins and needles waiting to hear what the requirements for returning to school would be in the fall. You know, the kids had already been through quite a trauma. Kindergarten through eighth grade students of mine, you know, having the school shut down for 3 months was hugely difficult for all of us, including me. You know, it was sad. I cried every day, and I know a lot of them did too, the ones we were still in touch with through that time. You know, it was very frightening. And so coming back to school, I was really wanted to make this as healing an experience as possible. These kids needed support, and I wanted to be there for them. But at the end of July, our superintendent said they had a school board meeting. They put it on Zoom, and what the superintendent told us was, we are going to ask you to do things that will go against your personal and professional judgment, but we need you, you know, to do them. And I don't do that. And for me, the line was the masks, because, and I did not know much about them at the time, because I had never heard of such a thing as masking, especially masking children. But I hadn't really come across masks in all my experience in healthcare, you know, so I didn't really know. You know, I've seen them on TV, surgeons wear them, but I did not even expect that to be something you would say, because my understanding of the general body of knowledge that we have about biology and viruses and bacteria is that would be the worst thing you would do, especially with a respiratory virus. That would be the worst thing you would do, is stifle someone's breathing.
Explain the reasoning behind that.
Well, there are many. And so that's why I started on this journey of gathering the research and doing some research of my own. So I quit my job after that Zoom school board meeting, because I just knew that I couldn't do that to children. My gut told me it was unhealthy, just from a background of, you know, knowing about asthma, COPD, developmental disabilities, just the emotional context of why children need to see faces and need to be able to speak. So my gut just told me this was very wrong. So I thought, well, hey, if I just gather evidence of the harms, you know, this definitely causes harms. And I had looked up the World Health Organization's, you know, input. They came out with a scientific brief, I think it was in June, and I cite all of this in my report. I really hope people will look at it and look at the 150 references from places like the Journal of American Medical Association and the CDC and the FDA and OSHA and the World Health Organization. And so what they said in June, they came out with a paper. The World Health Organization did not recommend their use unless there was widespread community transmission. And even then, they put in a lot of caveats, a lot of warnings, and they explained why. They cite all their sources. They cite why they have these conclusions. And it's because they don't work. First of all, masks don't work in preventing this type of stuff, except for these rare examples, you know, that I mentioned earlier that were sort of taken out of context. And really, there was no evidence. that they work. And second of all, they can be dangerous. They can spread viruses and bacteria. Third of all, we have no research on how they work in the community or what difficulties people are going to experience.
Talk about those isolated...
Well, things like the choir study, people will say, or the restaurant study, or the CDC. In my report, I cite, and you can find this online yourself, just the CDC's explanation, you know, why are masks effective? They have a website on it where they break it down, and they give 45, right now it's up to 45 references. It started out with about 20 back in June last year, and I've been watching this list grow over time, and you can look at all those studies, and I have, and they are not high quality. I mean, this is what the World Health Organization's words. I mean, I'm not making any of this up. I'm not the first person to say this, any of this. This is what's being said. The World Health Organization calls them not high-quality research. They're absolutely not conclusive. But not only are they not conclusive, but they're not even relevant, about half of them. And I have a website. It's vtmasksurvey.com. So VT, like Vermont, masksurvey.com. And on one of the pages there, I actually have a little cheat sheet that I developed that uses colors to show you what types of studies these 45 are and why they're not of the high quality, you know, to help people understand. So, you know, a lot of people say there's science on both sides. It depends on who you listen to. That's not actually true. You know, there is science. There's lots of research. There's lots of data. You know, but what a scientist does, or anyone who's thinking rationally, is they weigh that evidence. You know, just like in a court of law, you know, you weigh it. What's the source of this evidence? How valid? Were they even there at the time, you know?
But a key issue here is that almost everybody believes that masks are important in mitigating the spread of the coronavirus. And my guess is that many people listening right now will be having a knee-jerk reaction that you must be nuts or some kind of Trump supporter or conspiracy theorist, just because pretty much everybody has gotten, I think probably the best term would be in this case, they've been brainwashed by the incessant drumbeat of the media about using masks and all the issues around the spread of this virus.
Exactly. So
everything that we'll be talking about and that you'll be saying, I think you need to be talking about in the context of understanding how I think probably most people are going to be responding from a tendency to shut down, shut their ears and shut down any acceptance of what you're saying. And when you make the points that you make, I think you need to contextualize them in relation to where people are coming from in terms of listening and being able to hear it.
I know. That has been the biggest challenge about this, Tonio. Just that. That's what is also so mind-boggling to me. And it has required all of my skill and all of my prayer, really prayer at this point. I'm dumbfounded why simple biology is so hard for people to hear. So what I thought when I started my study, so I gathered evidence that Vermonters are experiencing the expected harms, you know, that you would expect when they wear masks, including difficulty breathing, you know, and we can get into all of them. And I thought, well, if I just present these, you know, that's all I need to, you know.
But Amy, as you present that information, again, contrast it with what the mainstream media or mainstream health voice is saying about the benefits of mask wearing and why they're claiming that wearing a mask is not only important but essential. So you do have an uphill climb to
right.
make with this, and keep that in mind, because I would like people to really consider what you're saying and not just check out because they think you're some wingnut or something, and that it's like you, a lone voice against everybody else, all the science, which is what everybody's saying. Listen to the science, follow the science. And the mainstream perspective on the science is overwhelmingly, just because it's obviously by far the loudest voice in the room, is saying that masks are essential, and also address why you think they are pushing this mask-wearing agenda in the face of what you're saying is very shaky science.
Yeah. Fortunately, I have a lot of experience with media literacy, too, and have examined how violence in the media and also all of these false health messages have been promoted in the past. You know, this is an historic, you know, repetition of same stuff, different day. And everybody, you know, of course, thinks that, you know, if I was around back when smoking was being promoted, you know, I would know better. I would know that it's hurting my throat. You know, I can feel that happening. I would be able to see through that. And the problem is that that's not how it works. If something is repeated over and over, like if I just keep calling this telephone a spaceship, right? And you and I keep talking, and for months we talk, and every time I talk to you, I call a telephone a spaceship. You know, eventually you're going to start calling it that, you know, especially if everyone around you starts calling it that. You know, it's that repetition, and you're right. People are, they've been isolated. It's sort of, if you've ever seen the power and control wheels for domestic violence, it's basically the power and control wheel has all been played out. People were isolated. They were left with only this one message from their isolator or imprisonator, from the person keeping them there, from the government, from the media. And it was repeated over and over while they were in a state of fear. And so, you know, there are a lot of things at play. I know a lot of what's been really the hardest, of course, has been that people I love most, I can't even talk to about this. It's really disturbing. There's a couple of things going on. You know, I've spent a lot of time looking at this. So have other researchers. You know, this is the bigger issue. This is, you know, what it's all based on, is what's happening to people's minds right now. And they're basically shutting down. They're shutting down for a number of reasons, out of dissociation because of that abuse cycle, because of what they've been through, you know, the fear. Fear shuts down the thinking, rational brain and makes it impossible to see the big picture, to weigh the evidence, to think rationally. So some people are in fear. There's also a bit of bribery going on, shall we say. You know, people, there's a lot of PPE money coming through to companies. There are checks coming from the government. You know, for some people, this whole process of this reaction to this virus has been in some ways profitable, you know, whether, either financially, or they get to stay home and not go to work. I mean, certainly, as much as I hated teaching on Zoom, definitely I didn't have to worry about keeping kids in their seats or not hurting each other, or, you know what I mean? There were a lot of other, I didn't have to clean desks. I did, you know, if I were to weigh, you know, the amount of tedious work involved, you know, it's definitely harder to teach kids in person, you know, and so there were a lot of hooks that people got snagged on. And now that they're snagged on those hooks, and like you mentioned, politics, in my report, I actually go into these different sections, including the politics. Is this about politics? And what my research of my survey, including, it was also supported by a Vermont Department of Health survey that was done last year, we both found similar things, that the people who seem to think it's about politics are people who hate Trump. And they hate him so much that any association with a Trumpster, you know, God forbid, people think I'm a Trumpster. You know, that would be the worst thing they could think. Second worst thing might be that people might think I don't care, that I'm selfish, right? So these are things we've been told. I've actually heard, you know, on BPR and other places that if you don't wear a mask, you're a sociopath. You know, there are actually psychologists trying to come out with mental illness definitions. And it's so bad, this painting of people who question this is so bad that, you know, the Vermont Department of Health did their survey a year ago, and I'm jealous of their data. They collected surveys from 650 people in Vermont, and they asked them two questions, you know, how frequently do you wear a mask, and why or why not? You know, what are your reasons? So I wrote to the Vermont Department of Health, and I was able to see the actual responses. They sent me the data sheet, and I cite this in my report. You can ask for it, too, if you want to see. And you can see the responses people gave, and it's very interesting. We have, you know, a lot of people who wear them because they want to show they care, you know. And this is probably the worst hook of all that people have gotten snagged on, is that it's a sign of care. It's a sign of love to suffocate yourself. I mean, this is oxygen deprivation is what we're talking about. It's for real. And carbon dioxide you know, high levels of it are extremely dangerous, and we've got them about six times as high as they should be for prolonged periods of time. That combination, according to OSHA, and I start my report with the biology as it's described in the original OSHA handbook that was written for the use of respirators in 1976. It was partly funded by Los Alamos and the CDC and OSHA and FDA. Everybody got in on this, and biggest problem with covering your nose and mouth is the problem with breath. Our bodies cannot store oxygen. We cannot store oxygen. We cannot say, oh, I'll breathe after school, or I'll wait to breathe after work. We constantly need it, and every single cell in our body needs oxygen every second in order to burn the glucose, you know, the fuel that it needs to stay alive. Every cell needs oxygen every second. And when you restrict that supply by a third, roughly, and we can get into that, it might be more. These masks that people are using, we don't know. When I say by about a third, I'm talking about what's been found with the use of N95s, which are built to be breathable for a reason, because they have to be. Otherwise, and I cite all of these credible, well-done studies of surgeons and healthcare providers who will experience, after just 20 minutes or so of wearing an N95 or surgical mask, they will start to experience the effects and symptoms of oxygen deprivation and carbon dioxide poisoning. And, you know, this affects their thinking, this affects their coordination, their performance, their health in so many ways. Countless ways. We have no idea how many different ways, but there's a lot of concern about it. And so now we're asking the general public to wear them, you know, for prolonged periods. And so, you know, what is the Vermont Department of Health interested in right now? Are they interested in how are people doing under their masks? Are they okay under there? No, they literally ignored the comments that said, I have asthma, I can't wear this. I have health conditions. This makes my health conditions worse. They ignored those answers. They also ignored the people who don't wear them and cited credible scientific reasons why. Instead, the purpose of their survey, the whole purpose they did this, was to promote the use of masks. You know, how do we get more people to use them? And so compliance has been the main focus of the Department of Health. So we're focused on making people do a medical intervention of all ages and all abilities, even the most vulnerable. We're making them do this medical intervention that we know has risks and harms, and we are only interested in making them do it.
So my question here is, we have people in the Vermont Health Department, not even to mention elsewhere in the country and in the world at various levels in the hierarchies, who supposedly understand health science and have some experience in this field. Why are they pushing this compliance agenda if they, well, let's say if they should know that the benefits are outweighed by the harms?
Right, they should know. Like any person should know. I mean, it's basic biology. I have a good example I just want to squeeze in, and then I will answer that why question. I remember being a little kid and being afraid of, like, monsters under my bed or something was in the hall. Do you ever remember feeling that way when you were a child?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I still do.
So when I was a kid and I felt that way, I remember putting my head under the covers, mm-hmm. you know, trying to hide. I mean, right. I didn't want my fingers to poke out.
Right, you know? That magic blanket.
Right, that you figure out how to keep your hands inside and pull it over your head so that nothing was poking out. And what would happen? Well, after not very long, I would start needing air, right? No matter how badly I wanted to stay under those covers and how scared I was, I remember, like, opening the covers just a little bit so that my mouth could go up to it and breathe, thinking, like, well, at least I'm still mostly hidden, you know, from the monster. And eventually, my need for air, and it wouldn't take very long at all, would be so severe that even my fear, right, mm-hmm. would be overpowered because I'd have to come out and breathe.
Yeah, I remember that too.
And I also remember figuring it out as a child, right, that I could tent the covers a little bit. If I just tented them, you know, if I didn't have the covers right up to my face, if I pushed them up a little bit and lifted my knees and made like a little tent under there that I could stay longer, right? If there was a little more air in there for me to use up. Okay, so when you say they should know better, I mean, I know that they've actually removed human biology from the science standards for elementary schools. Did you know that?
No. And in what way?
The Common Core science standards that science teachers have to teach now in Vermont, as of about, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe 5 years ago or so, these were implemented, that every science teacher in every school has to follow these, you know, address these science standards. And they removed human biology. The way I found out was my students. My students started complaining. And also some other teachers in my school started giving away all of their anatomy stuff. You know, they had these cool dolls that you could disassemble that had the guts in them and everything, you know, and these cool charts and things. And I kept finding them in the free pile. And so I asked teachers, too. And I found out through the kids and the teachers that they're not teaching that stuff anymore. You know, and the kids were upset about it. I actually had some students who were going to start a petition. You know, so I started to try to include as much biology, which I always did anyway. I love biology. I think that's what we need to understand so we can be healthy and take care of our bodies. You know, we understand the reasoning behind eating well, you know, and the reasoning behind not smoking, if you know how important unrestricted breathing is, you know, and things like that. So I squeezed in as much biology into my health curriculum as I could, but I already felt like I was bursting at the seams with all the subjects I had to cover, so it was difficult, but I did. I tried my best. And so, you know, it's just funny to me how we're leaving behind. It's not just funny. It's very sad. Anyway, you know, if children should know this stuff just instinctively, these medical professionals definitely do. They know. And I'm hearing more and more from people that their doctors are telling them, yeah, these masks don't work. You know, I mean, they know it. They know they don't. They absolutely know they don't, based on the size of virus particles. And I get into all of this in the report. I really hope people will read it. It's concise as I could make it with as many resources and references. I mean, these are not my opinions.
Well, since you mentioned particle size in relation to masks and many doctors saying that masks just don't work, can you just quickly explain why they don't work in relation to particle size and the particle issue?
Yeah, well, first of all, they don't create a tight fit, most of them, you know, the surgical masks, things like that. Second of all, they're not a fine enough filter. And so the only reason why they're approved at all for what they're being used for is through the Food and Drug Administration's emergency use authorization, which I describe in the timeline. People will just look at the report, you know, and they look at the timeline and definitions as well. Under the definitions sections, I explain the different types of masks. And so you have FFRs, which are full frontal face respirators. Those are things like N95s. And N95s can block up to 95% of particles that are larger than 0.075 micrometers.
And are micrometers microns?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, this virus particle is actually 0.6, according to most resources. So 0.6, that still can slip through an N95. But the point of an N95 is so that healthcare providers, if they are in an environment where there's a lot of condensation of these aerosolized droplets you've heard so much about, like in a tight room where they're close to somebody, they can protect the wearer to a degree, that 95% degree, only if they are properly worn, they have to be fit tested, they have to be checked, the person has to be trained on how to use them. And again, they should never be using them for prolonged periods. You know, that's a whole other issue.
And then all the men who have beards.
Right, beards are not allowable. No, that they won't work with beards. They won't work with any jaw disfigurement you might have. There are lots of reasons.
So anyway, I just want to quickly interject. My understanding of the benefits of the mask were to prevent the spread of the large droplets, that the aerosolized particles obviously are not going to be stopped by the mask, but it's the large particles, because also there's the understanding that it takes a certain critical mass of actual virus material to actually overwhelm the immune system.
Right. Like for a couple of the sources that the CDC cites as evidence that masks work, a couple of them are in airplanes, and one's on a Navy ship. And so, you know, you just think about the air circulation issues, you know, in both of those environments. You know, you think about the closeness. I've walked on those Navy ships. I mean, you have to squeeze past each other in the hallways and things, and there are numbers of people in small spaces. So whether those three studies are even accurate or conclusive at all, you know, they're not relevant to community settings at all. And so FFRs, these full face piece respirators, are the only ones that have ever been approved to protect the wearer, you know, the person wearing them. And they usually have an exhalation valve. They've experimented. This is how serious restricted breathing is. Restricting someone's breathing by covering their face and mouth is so serious that, you know, in order to try to develop them, you know, this is what it's all been about in the technology, is how do we make these things wearable? I mean, they've been struggling this for decades, and so they've figured out that they can put a little exhalation valve in the FFRs, which, of course, they say don't use those now with corona because you're actually still going to be breathing out the particles. Well, yeah, that exhalation valve is so that the wearer can have a little bit more comfort and actually be able to exhale the CO2, which is super important because as that CO2 builds up under the mask, this is an extremely dangerous environment.
And it's also interesting how the compliance mandate is about wearing a mask, and there's very little about the quality of the mask or what mask you wear, because there's all kinds of masks out there.
Exactly.
With a lot of controversial evaluations of how well these different types of masks work.
Right, and in fact, they don't want to get into that, probably. That's where the crux of the issue lies. What people are using are not at all approved. They're not approved. They would never be approved. So these three types of masks, there's the ones I just described that might provide some protection, but they're still under review. This is the mountain of evidence that I discovered that I was so surprised existed because I had never looked at it before, you know, the use of masks in healthcare settings and how effective are they. It turns out that's a huge debate because of the risks. Do they outweigh the benefits? They're having a real hard time proving that the benefits are at all, you know, at all. And so they're still working on that issue with the FFRs. Then you have something called a surgical mask, which, you know, is antimicrobial. It's to protect you from those larger droplets you just mentioned, right? The ones coming out of your mouth if you cough or sneeze. The only times that you would need that kind of surgical mask would be for splashes, right? If you're in surgery or you're doing the dental procedure on somebody, you know, unpleasant splashes might come towards your face.
Well, also, there are quite a few people who talk rather vociferously or aggressively, and occasionally, you know, spit flies from their mouth and kind of gets all over everybody they're talking to.
It would have to get in your mouth, and like you said, a certain amount of it, and you'd have to be fairly close for quite a period of time. You know, even the so-called evidence they have saying masks work, you know, you'd have to be close to that person for a fairly good amount of time. And another thing that, you know, I don't want us to get off the track we're on, but I do discuss in here the pros and cons of masks. And people without symptoms do not spread COVID. If they do, it's so rare that we can't even find documentation of it, really. This is how clear the evidence is. And more keeps coming out every day. So if someone is not coughing and sneezing and symptomatic, they can spit in your mouth and you might get hepatitis. You know, I mean, how come we're not worried about that? You know, that we can document. You know, how likely are you to get hepatitis C? And that's why, you know, some of people listening may have had their hepatitis C vaccine, because they work in, you know, with people, different healthcare situations, you know, prisons, all that stuff. Even that, you know, how many people do you know who have caught hepatitis C, which is fairly contagious, from someone who's talking to them? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, that's going out on such a limb.
Mm-hmm.
If that was possible, I mean, the chances of it happening are so low that to then mask the entire population to prevent that rare, exceedingly weird case, it's just not reasonable.
Yeah, so then it sounds like just doing the social distancing, staying 6 feet apart from people, should be sufficient without a mask.
Or 3 feet, like they say in the UK and all of Europe and the World Health, half of what they're telling us here. You know, why are we using these extreme? And that's harmful. You know, even the 6 feet is weird, and that we don't have any, there's no science behind, you know, there's no, I mean, people can do things in laboratories and show droplet. I've seen all these, people send me all kinds of great, you know, journal articles written by the media showing these laboratory experiments, you know, with these, it's just, it has no relevance, like my example with hepatitis C. I mean, there's no relevance to it.
And what about this obsession? You know, people are washing their hands like 20, 30, 50 times a day. They're using hand sanitizer. What about that? What about the consequences of that?
Oh, in fact, they're telling you not to now. Yeah, because the health effects are rolling in. That's not healthy.
And how so?
Well, breaking down our natural bacteria. You know, if that spittle lands on your face, you know, you have natural bacteria that will handle that. But if you're constantly, you know, breaking that down, you know, which we could talk about the hygiene problem with masks, too. If I could just finish these three types of masks, you know, so we have the N95 types, the FFRs, mm-hmm. that might do something, right, in a medical setting type of thing where it's sterile and you're not touching it and it fits properly and you're trained. And then we have surgical masks, which are to prevent against those splashes so you don't sneeze in your patient's wound, you know, and so that their blood doesn't splatter in your mouth. You know, that's what those are for. And then we have face masks. Now, these are a brand new invention. They've never been approved. They've never been used.
You mean like cloth masks?
Yeah. So this is what the FDA calls it. It's a mask that covers the user's nose and mouth. And so have they ever been shown to work? No. Have we ever tested how much they restrict breathing or how much they gather bacteria or how much moisture? Actually, the amount of moisture they gather, that your mask, how moist it gets. You know, that's why surgical masks and FFRs are made out of certain specific materials, because they're made to dry quickly. Because the more moisture that builds up in there, of course, you have skin's going to start breaking down, which causes more risk of infection. You have bacteria growing, and the mask becomes less breathable the more moist it gets. And that's why prolonged wear, wearing it for longer than 20, 30 minutes or an hour, you know, we don't know what that does. It would be too dangerous and unethical to do the research to see what prolonged use on children will do. No one would let you do that study normally, because that would be unethical.
So all those fashionable artistic face masks are in that category.
Yes, and they were only approved by the FDA temporarily under this emergency use authorization so that the use of surgical masks and these FFRs could be reserved for the people who need them. Because, see, what would happen is the public panics, and for some reason, everyone seems to think wearing a mask is a good idea. And for some reason, everybody's running out and wanting to buy them up. And what are we going to do? You know, because then nurses won't have them and, you know, things like that. So they allowed, under this EUA.
What is EUA?
Emergency use authorization.
Got it.
It's only because a state of emergency was declared. And I explain this in my timeline. You can look it right up, you know, why the FDA passed their thing and why the federal government said it was an emergency. And so, you know, it's a domino effect. This part of the government says this, now the FDA has to scramble. How are we going to get these masks and get enough masks? Well, we've got to just approve anything. And they even loosened the manufacturing requirements. So these masks can be made without oversight, without testing. I mean, that's why if you read the actual boxes, they say, you know, not approved. You know, take off if you have any difficulties. And in fact, you know, I document in my research, because I was finding that Vermonters are experiencing sore throats, you know, that you get a sore throat wearing one. And there are a number of reasons for that. What they found up in Canada is they actually had to recall these masks that the government had distributed to daycares, to the state busing up there, transportation, all these departments. And it turned out that some consumer thought to complain about sore throats, and they looked into it. And these masks were made out of dangerous materials, and when you breathe them in, a sore throat is what you experience. And see, this is a lot of the problem. When the FDA did this emergency use authorization, you know, because it was an emergency, they rushed it right through. I have, you know, numerous Vermonters who are complaining of these things, sore throats, oxygen levels dropping when they wear them when they're pregnant, and supply issues. I had a construction worker write into the survey saying that they can no longer find the proper N95 FFR-type masks that they need in their job to do insulation or, you know, these other construction environments where that's what these masks were created for, were these larger particulates, you know, in the air that can, we know, cause lung problems and cancers and diseases. And, and that's what they're approved for, and now these people can't find them. And they're being forced to wear these face masks. I actually went to Home Depot, you know, and was looking around, and they are not available. The proper respiratory protection that construction workers need are not available. All they have in these aisles at the store are these unapproved. They look like surgical masks, but they're not. They're not medical masks. They are these, you know, emergency use authorized, produced who knows where by who knows what materials, and they're not going to offer the protection. So, you know, the whole purpose of this emergency use authorization was to protect the supplies, and it did not do that. So you would think that that would be information they were interested in hearing. And that's the problem here, is we've got agencies and the media and even our loved ones and school boards, and people are just covering their ears. They don't want to know this crucial information. This is the whole point of why we did this so-called this medical intervention, and we're not paying attention to the results. I mean, that's just madness, really.
So is the mask mandate really about assuaging public fear and giving them a kind of false sense of security or control?
They are a feel-good thing. And then what I uncovered in my research was that the use of requiring masks have been used in medical settings for years as part of what's called a vaccine or mask policy. I cite in my report just one example from up in Ontario, Canada. The Nurses Association up there, it's a union, you know, sued the hospital that they were working at because they were being forced to wear masks if they did not get the flu vaccine, the annual flu vaccine. And so they sued. And in the initial findings, the arbitrator says, my finding is these are being used as coercion. This is coercion. Not only have these masks been found not to work, they've been found to interfere with patient relationships, with your job, with your health. They're uncomfortable, but they are being used to coerce. And so when I said that I think the report is more relevant today than maybe it even, although I wish people would have listened to it a year ago and we could have prevented countless harms that we're causing, especially to children right now. It's horrifying. But now I heard about, you know, at my school that I left, you know, I heard that they had eighth grade graduation the other day, you know, and my eighth graders, most of whom, you know, I saw over those 10 years grow up, you know, I love them. And it was a nice thought to think that, oh, good, they had their graduation. Well, the students outside still had to wear masks if they weren't vaccinated. You know, everybody who was not vaccinated had to wear masks, which meant that most of the eighth graders did. And also the younger children singing. I guess there was a group of, you know, younger kids who came to sing to honor the older kids. And that's one of the most beautiful parts, you know, about a multi-age school like that. I love, you know, integrating the kids of multi-ages. They had to wear masks to sing. I mean, if my head is under those covers and I'm a little kid and I'm trying to breathe, but I'm going to keep you under those covers, I'm not going to let you out. And that's a little bit of what's so scary to me, Tonio, is, you know, of course my heart is with the kids, even though my study was of adults by necessity because they're the ones who can answer the survey. But kids have not been given a choice through this. You know, adults could, if they had to, although it would be very difficult, you know, leave their job. You know, most of the people who wrote into my survey who experienced difficulties every time they wear a mask, they're required to wear them at work. It's the main reason people wear them, not for safety or control or whatever. It's just to keep their job. So adults could, though. We could leave our job or at work. I've heard people are sneaking. People are taking cheating breaths and, you know, running to the bathroom to breathe. That's what one of the nurses wrote in to tell me. You know, they're hiding in the bathroom to breathe. You know, so adults can do these things. We can work the system. We can get a new job. We can, you know, do these things. But kids in a classroom, you know, and the way the COVID rules were, they weren't even allowed out of those rooms. You know, they weren't even allowed to go to specials, you know, in other locations. They were kept in those rooms all day. And police, I don't know how severely, it depends on your teacher, I assume, but all kinds of things I've heard are being used, not locally, but I've heard of all kinds of, you know, if you're not behaving, you can't take your mask off. You know, if you don't wear your mask all the time, you can't go to music class. You know, these are the things kids live for, you know, recess being withheld. You know, who knows what kinds of punitive measures have been used to keep these kids in these masks. And they have developing brains. I mean, this oxygen issue, this is serious. And a lot of people say, you know, well, we've tested the blood oxygen. You know, we can put one of those little monitors on your finger when you wear a mask, and we can prove that your blood oxygen levels don't drop. And that's true for most people, you know, unless you're pregnant or maybe possibly obese folks might have more trouble with that. But for most people, no, your blood oxygen level will not drop. But blood oxygen levels are not an indicator of oxygen deprivation. The early symptoms of oxygen deprivation are things like dizziness, lack of coordination, headaches, rapid breathing, difficulty breathing. You know, these are the symptoms people and children and everyone who wears a mask pretty much, you know, experiences to some level. And if you add any amount of stress to the body, like any amount of extra exertion that requires more oxygen, then that just keeps compounding. You know, as your need for oxygen rises and the lack of its supply increases, that's why prolonged use is so dangerous, because the longer you stay in the state that's just going downhill fast, the more dangerous it is. And so, you know, if you stand up, just stand up, 20% more blood goes to your brain. And so, you know, you need 20% more oxygen. If you're stressed emotionally, you're going to need more oxygen. So anybody with PTSD or trauma, you know, we have these children returning to school and they can't see their teachers' faces. And I mean, you remember the first day of school, you know, you don't know your teacher, who's in your class. And I mean, the stress levels, right? And so now your body needs more oxygen. And just the wearing of the mask, they've shown, you know, OSHA is concerned about this, that just putting on a mask creates a need for more oxygen because of the restriction, because your body is now, you're sucking, right? Like through a straw, you're sucking harder, and it actually causes strain in your nasal passages and your lungs that can last beyond the use of the mask. You take off that mask, they can still see those changes in your nasal passages from the strain, the stress of pulling. So this is serious. So we've got children who now still, under the Agency of Education recommendations and what I'm hearing from local superintendents and school policies, are these kids are still wearing masks. They're still wearing them for sports, which is super dangerous. They're still wearing them for summer school in the heat. We know heat causes extra stress on your body. OSHA has special recommendations and guidelines for working in hot environments with respirators. And our officials, I mean, I'm sorry to anyone who's listening right now and is having a hard time hearing this. It just makes me so angry that our media and our government are working together to ignore this information. And now they've changed the mandate. You know, and there are plenty of people who cannot get a vaccine for various health issues. And probably those health issues in a lot of cases will be exacerbated or could very likely be exacerbated by wearing a mask. So we are taking those very vulnerable people and putting them, I want to heal the planet. I want everybody to be healthy and as strong as they can be and happy and comfortable and at peace and breathing and relaxed and feeling safe on this whole planet. That's been my mission through my whole health career. And that's not what's happening with these policies at all.
And the dissenting voices are getting railed at and condemned and attacked. And one thing I noticed, I don't listen to Amy Goodman very often, but she ends her show by saying, wear a mask.
I know.
And it just really bugs me, this brainwashing aspect of the media. And she's just perpetuating this mindless repetition of the party line. And it seems as though the left has aligned itself, you know, based on the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So if Trump advocates anything, we're going to take the opposite position without thinking about it. And his whole thing around masks and hydroxychloroquine with zinc that he was taking prophylactically. And I didn't really know anything about that. But then I started seeing online lots of doctors are using hydroxychloroquine with zinc and saying that they're having 100% positive results with it, including with patients who have extreme symptoms. And yet the mainstream health officials are saying that it doesn't work, their line is, it hasn't been proven. And so many things in our scientific and medical fields are based upon what has been proven by these stringent and very expensive to do standards.
Right. And a lot of those treatments that do work with COVID are very cheap. They're like anti-malarial medicines and things. And the reason is, if we had a treatment, we would not be able to, through emergency use authorization, approve these shots or any of these medical interventions that are being not just proposed, not just suggested, but, you know, as it goes down the line, mandated.
You mean the vaccines?
Right, and the masks. You know, if we had a treatment, we would not be able to. You know, the FDA approval would not have been able to happen if there was a treatment or treatments like there appears to be. Or how about, you know, my concern is we've got people showing up in the hospital complaining of respiratory problems or whatever they're complaining of. We're slapping a mask on their face. You know, what does that do?
So
maybe that's compounding it, you know.
So what this is reminding me of is most of us, you know, on the left, we have, over the years, we have come to realize that we absolutely cannot trust the government or anything it says.
Mm-hmm.
However, in certain areas, we will ignore our historical perspective and essentially write the government a blank check in terms of whatever they say in certain areas. And I think it boils down to these kind of usually health related issues where people are scared. And as you've mentioned, when people are scared, their ability to think rationally is shut down. I mean, it's completely shut down, and they're responding through their reptilian brain, and they're not thinking, they're not questioning, they're just having a knee-jerk response out of survival mode, and they're listening to the loudest voice without question.
Right, I mean, that's why, you know, if police come into a scene, they know how to sound like an authority. Get on the floor, sit down, you know. I mean, definitely, it's been deafening that it's hard to hear otherwise. However, I've been hugely heartened through my process here because there are lots of people who are still thinking rationally. There are tons and tons, countless professionals at all levels of, you know, medical establishments, the World Health Organization, you know, everywhere, trying to yell from the hilltops to bring attention to, for example, this mask issue, you know, or any of these other issues like
right.
the lockdown.
But you have to actually make a concerted effort to find those voices, because
right.
the mainstream media, and that includes the left and Amy Goodman and Tom Hartman and people like that, they will not cover any of it.
No, I cannot believe the media outlets that have turned me down that won't even answer. The Front Porch Forum won't let me post, you know, my mask survey. I tried to post something over the summer and they told me it violates their corona policy. Vermont Digger refunded my money. I tried to pay to have a press release printed there about the mask survey initial results back in October, you know, because I had so many just hugely concerning results already. I felt like I had to get them out. This is urgent.
So what's that about? What the media is supposed to be unbiased and report fairly on everything. So what's going on? Why would they respond this way? Why would they behave this way?
Well, you know, it's now legal to have propaganda on the media. You know, there is no division anymore. And we started to see this, you know, back when I was doing media literacy, you know, back in the day in the 90s, you know, how the pharmaceutical companies were moving into, you know, television, and how media ownership, you know, started to condense and consolidate. And people don't realize this, but when you're watching the news at night, there are paid advertisements in there. I mean, for decades, you know, since these laws have been repealed, that there's various laws that protected us from this, they've all been repealed. You know, like the fact that they can now, starting in the 1970s, they were able to advertise directly to children. You know, that was a new thing. They weren't allowed before that. And so I grew up in the 70s. I think we're kind of around the same age, Tonio. And, you know, we started to see commercials aimed at us for cereal. Oh, the cereal, it's healthy, whatever, it's fun to eat, you know. What does a kid know, right? What does a kid know about what's good to eat first thing in the morning? And so they started to, you know, to advertise directly to children. They started to put pharmaceutical ads in your news. You know, you don't realize, but when you're watching you know, the news, and if they come on and say eggs are bad for you or butter is bad for you, remember that, the whole cholesterol thing, which has been hugely debunked, although most people don't know that. If they listen to, you know, the pharmaceutical news that they listen to, you know, there's money behind this and power. So, you know, if they don't want you to eat eggs, if one, you know, food industry wants to take over another, or if, you know, they want you to get on Lipitor, or they want you, you know, to believe that caffeine is now good for you. I mean, you hear all these things on the news, and sometimes they're so sensational. You go, oh, geez, that's crazy, you know. But for the most part, it just washes right in. And as we just let it wash in, I mean, all of those side effects that they list at the end of the commercials, they study this. They study the brain. I mean, that's where I've learned about the brain and how the media affects it, is from the research they've done to perfect their advertising. You know, this is old stuff. And I do feel heartened. I mean, even though the media is ignoring it and our government officials are ignoring it, in every field, people are still speaking out at the risk of everything. I mean, these people, you know, are risking everything, because that's how it felt. That's how it felt to me. I was afraid to even put my name on the survey. You know, I did receive threats, but even before, I knew I was going to receive the threats. You know, that was the weird thing. Like, I knew it. I was afraid to open my email when I first started my Vermont Mask survey, and I hung up the posters around the, you know, state. I started hanging them up, and I started to get emails, and, you know, some of it was quite nasty. You know, of course, the preponderant, most of it, was hugely full of gratitude and thank you for doing this, and heart-wrenching, you know, testimonies that I'm on the right track, you know, and then all the research I kept finding, and all of these scientists and doctors are coming out and, like I said, screaming from the mountaintops. If anybody would just turn off their TV and listen, you know, we might hear them. They're growing by the day. I have a list on my website of professionals speaking out, and I could add to it every day. And that is just heartening to me, you know, because it's just basics. It's basic biology.
But again, people would have to seek it out in order to hear it.
Right. But it is happening. You know, just because it wasn't on TV, that doesn't make it not true, right? And so
right.
The revolution will not be televised.
But most
right?
people are very lazy. They just turn on the television set and they open their mouth metaphorically and let it all get shoveled down their throat.
No,
without question. And this issue of media literacy that you're talking about, you know, we understand fascism as government and business, you know, colluding together. But in our country, we have media and government colluding together. This is like an issue of media fascism, you could call it.
Right. And it's not just our country.
It's not just our country. However, in many other parts of the world, they understand that their government is always lying. Like,
yeah.
Like the Russian people, they say they don't believe anything their government tells mm-hmm. them. In fact, they know that as soon as the government says anything, that they start looking at all the other possible ways of thinking about something or seeing things. And in South America, unless you're a right-wing fascist, you know the government is lying all the time, pretty much.
Right. But they still get away with what they do, right? And
of course.
Because we in our individual positions keep cooperating.
Exactly. We comply.
We comply. And a lot of people are complying. You know, my gut feeling, and also from my survey and from the survey results from the Vermont Department of Health and other places, you know, around the country, is that most people can see through this. Really, really. Most people do. I mean, most of these people being forced to wear these masks at work, you know, they know the health effects. They know their kids are suffering. We've got parents who just sent their masks in to get tested, you know, for bacteria and things down in Florida and found dangerous levels. That's a very interesting little study, you know, that was done. But because it's so small, people say, oh, it's small, those are low numbers. But not when you look at those results and you say, wow, they are confirmed by this mountain of research. You know, these small results are identical to what we would have expected. You know, that actually confirms both ways. And so, you know, people are very well aware that this is not healthy. What we need to do, you know, and that's why I've been bringing my results to school boards and to select boards and my regional planning commission, and I'm usually turned down and not allowed to have time on the agenda. My co-op as well, I've been talking to fervently and just trying to get some reason in there. And it's interesting how a lot of people won't even engage, but I still keep showing up because it's just so important that people at these levels, you know, we are the decision makers. We are very fortunate in the United States. We do not have it as bad as some other countries as far as these COVID restrictions and health mandates and things. And part of that is our Constitution is protecting us. And so if you read the language that's coming down from the Department of Health and coming down from the CDC and even the governor's mandate, you know, these are recommendations. Recommendations. And the reason why they can't require them, I believe, I'm not a lawyer, but my guess is it has something to do with they can't prove that they work, they can't prove they're necessary, and they can't prove that they're safe. You know, so if they would be on the hook if they made you do it. And so they can't make you do it because they understand how liability works, you know, and so they're going to let the folks lower on the totem pole do it. You know, it's sort of like drug dealers, right? Letting the small-time guys get busted, you know. So we're going to let the school boards make these decisions. We're going to let business owners impose medical interventions on their customers, on their employees, you know, that have dangerous side effects, well-known dangerous side effects. And they're going to, you know, because that's private property somehow, they're allowed to do that. These decisions are being made on the ground, and that's why I can't stop speaking about it. And even though, you know, I've had some rejection for sure and threats and things along the way, what I mostly get are doors opening. You know, like you, Tonio, you know, I love GDR. You know, I'm a Goddard graduate. I've been on the GDR Community Advisory Board for over a decade. I'm a programmer. You know, no offense to GDR at all. Tonio, you've been the only one who will let me come on and talk about this.
Really? You've actually asked other people?
I have actually asked, and I won't, you know, I won't say, but we will keep that, you know, just like I won't say which press I've talked to personally and have been told, you know. So, for example, I wrote an open letter to Dr. Levine in February. I said, you know, as we're coming up on the first anniversary of these health mandates, you know, let's do a cost-benefit analysis. Are they working? You know, and I handed it to him, actually, in person. I actually gave it to him outside of his press conference one day, and he ran away. He would not even stop and answer a single question, ran away, literally closed the door in my face. And in this letter, I cited, and I do it in my report too, a study that Dr. Levine co-authored. And it was published by UVM, and I just stumbled on it, Tonio, because I was looking for something else, and I stumbled on the study that UVM published. And they studied the effectiveness of masks. And what they found was that masks increase the likelihood of spreading the virus, that children do not spread the virus. And so these are two findings that are well documented. They are what you would expect. Okay, it's not that this was an isolated event. I mean, these are the results you'd expect based on the research previously done. And you've never heard of that study, probably. I had never heard of it. And when I tried to get this letter published, I was told by a very small local paper, you know, that I had to qualify it. I had to say that this study wasn't peer-reviewed, and I would have to follow it up with the CDC guidance. And I tried to explain to this editor that, well, if you read two paragraphs down, you'll see that I do refer to that CDC guidance. I refer to those 45 studies. I mean, all of that was covered. This editor, Tonio, had not even, first of all, read my letter and checked my sources, and then was coming back to me with criticism and corrections based on fact-checking websites he had gone to. So he went to fact-checking websites, which people really need to do their research on how all of this is connected to, you know, Google, Microsoft, Big Farm. You know, these companies are all coordinating all of this social media, and that's why it's a little bit frightening to me. I was listening to GDR last night, and I heard somebody talking. I didn't catch the context, but it was some experienced woman with some research and information to share, and what she was saying was that they need to be more strict about keeping the lies out, the bold, outright lies. And what she was talking about, not directly, but she was talking about information like mine, like this information, like any information that goes against what this group or whoever they are have decided is the truth.
And they're very cleverly utilizing social acceptance, you know, herd mentality to get people to accept these things that you say people are seeing through. But I think that they're so concerned about their place in the herd, in society, and being accepted and feeling like they'll be accepted and won't be ostracized. I think there's a lot of fear around thinking for oneself. And there's a lot of talk nowadays about authenticity, and that includes political authenticity and the authenticity that comes out of having the presence of mind and courage to question authority and to think for oneself and to quite literally take back one's own mind from the mainstream media, government, hive mind mentality.
Right, and that is what gives me hope. As long as, you know, this whole process and how afraid I was to come out and even give my name to it, you know, and all of this, you know, I have discovered so much courage inside myself, and I have never felt more sure of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and that it's the right thing. And this is happening everywhere, not just, you know, for me. I'm seeing that this is happening to people all around. It's like necessity is the mother of invention. You know, we are being put in this corner, and we are given just a couple options, you know, and they're all big ones, and they all have serious consequences. And, you know, people are choosing, you know, the lazy way out. Ah, that's not my problem. What can I do? It's hopeless. You know, there are a lot of reasons that people could cop out for different reasons, go along with it, whatever. Or we can stand up. You know, we can find our courage. And people are. And I just can't help, you know, because I found mine. And I know that that's because, you know, largely probably because, you know, I've done a lot of healing work. I also don't have a history of severe trauma. You know, I don't have these triggers. You know, I know how to eat dandelions, and I own my home, you know, so I could quit my job. You know, I have the ability. I have this history and media literacy, history and trauma. I can see this big picture. So therefore, I am responsible. You know what I mean? I'm responsible to do what I can. That I have to. And other people are finding that too. You know, we could, like, finally throw off these chains of slavery and, just like you said, start thinking for ourselves.
But you make a really good point in defining the advantageous position that you're in. Most people don't have those advantages that you have, and they live in perpetual fear of losing their jobs or not being able to pay their rent or pay for the basic necessities of survival. And many people have children, which exponentially increases their fear along those survival levels, making it quite literally impossible for them to think outside of the narrow little kitty litter box that we are being presented with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sharing your optimism. I mean, I appreciate you having that optimism, but I don't share that. I see most people living in fear and kowtowing to the quite literally traumatic effects of being imprisoned in a kind of a wage slavery system, which then co-opts their minds so that they feel like they have no choice, or their reptilian brain doesn't allow them to think outside of that narrow box.
Right.
And I think that applies also to well-educated people who we would think should know better, or at least be able to see through these things. But they, out of what you had talked about near the beginning of the conversation, out of concern for the rest of the community, out of this sense of goodness, they're willing to give up their autonomy, their own critical thinking, and just go along with the party line, with the social herd line, not to make waves, so that they will be accepted and so they can feel comfortable. I think it really boils down to people wanting to feel comfortable within the herd.
Yeah, you know, I always learn something when I talk with you, and you're making me think of maybe why this population, like, I was dumbfounded too, because I thought, you know, I go in my co-op and I can see they have the bumper sticker, question authority. You know, that's a key philosophy. So how is it that this community in particular have become the police force, really? You know, the on-the-ground, boots on the ground, social and physical police force for this whole thing. You know, people who should be more aware of their privilege, right? We've been working on that. I am aware that I'm privileged. You know, therefore, it is my responsibility to think of others more and to do more if I can. And how did those people in particular, and that that was probably a really crucial step to make this all happen. That that population in particular had to be rounded up because they're holding each other there. You know, they really are through social. I mean, to be excluded from that group, you know, is devastating. When that is your group or your family,
especially when you are living under the trauma of wage slavery and societal mind slavery.
Yeah, the social pressure. In my report, I cite some evidence from the Vermont Department of Health survey that I talked about earlier. They had gathered over 650 responses, and amongst those responses were three that specifically, these were all three from people who are over 65 years old, our elders, right? All three of them noted that it was social pressure to avoid public ridicule and shunning because I don't want to be criticized. You know, this is why they're wearing masks, to avoid public ridicule and shunning. What kind of society do we live in? We are choosing to make this our society right now, where elders feel pressured. They're afraid of being ridiculed. When I read that, I just thought, how did they not just, you know, I'm tearing up right now. How did they not burst into tears, you know? And maybe because of my background, you know, working with abuse survivors, and, you know, I've done body work and therapeutic touch, you know, energy field. I've learned, and I'm learning every day, how to feel empathy for these situations and at the same time act. You know, like we can get frozen too in our empathy and just, you know, it's so big and it's so overwhelming. And, you know, that just gives me more reason to act, you know, for that 65-year-old woman who feels like she's going to be shunned and ridiculed, going out in public and breathing. I mean, I just, it's like, where are we? I mean, that's part of the psychological warfare, too, is that people in our position who can kind of see this, breath is life. I mean, you look it up, look up the definition of breath. I was looking that up the other day, and it means life. You know, and so we have co-ops and school boards and neighbors and friends and parents and teachers, you know, stifling that and how bad that is. You know, we talked last time about that tunnel vision effect, and I've really been thinking about that, about how, you know, I've written this whole report, and I have loved ones who won't even look at it, can't get past the first sentence because it doesn't match their vision they have, and they can't open beyond that. And we need to heal that. You know, how do we heal people's thinking habits? And then you add the oxygen deprivation factor on top and the high CO2 levels. You know, we're going to need to do some serious healing and serious heart healing and teaching people to relate to each other again and teaching children how to smile. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of work to do.
So are you going to return to school with the kids?
You know, when I was preparing for the show, you know, it made me think, how do I want to start? And I really wanted to start with why I was teaching, you know, and what I loved most about it, because I do want to get back to that. You know, the teaching kids how to grow food and, you know, be on the planet and how to stretch and move their bodies and play. I mean, I always, always worked play into my classes. And one of my students actually nicknamed me Ms. Fun Blast instead of Horn Blast. She said, because we always have so much fun in health class. And I was like, yay, you know, that because if they want to come, if they want to learn, you know, that's a big part of it. And learning is fun. I mean, doing this report, this is like what I love to do. I love to read things and think about them and do research and look at it from different angles. You know, I've been doing that since I was a little kid. I used to do research projects for fun. I mean, you know, that's the kind of person I am.
I think that's something that most people don't understand, that when kids are having fun, their minds open and they become much more receptive to learning, much more able to learn, whereas when they're bored and they're fidgeting and they just want to get out and do something else, their minds shut down and they aren't receptive to learning. So it's counterproductive the way our school systems operate and the kind of thinking that underlies it, that kids are mandated to sit in their seats in classrooms all the time and that fun and play are not prioritized at all.
And we have not prioritized children through this. I mean, this has been breaking my heart so badly. You know, the kids asked, they had some kind of kids gathering or conference in the spring, and it was on the same day that I went up to Dr. Levine and handed him my open letter outside of the press conference. there was a woman there who was talking about, you know, this conference she had had with kids, and one of the kids' top priorities, in fact, I think it was the last one she mentioned, and she probably chose that to bring emphasis to it, what she said was, and we want to take these masks off as soon as possible. And, of course, kids are loving creatures. They will do anything to protect us, you know, to care about, if we've taught them this. And they think the masks are going to protect them or are going to protect other people, and they're not. They actually can make it worse. I mean, the research shows can make it worse. And that we're not even, you know, looking at that. You know, don't listen to me. Don't trust anything that anybody tells you. You know, check it out. Check it out inside. Check it out in the research. And I've made it really easy. So what this report turned out to be was it's more than just my results. It's the most pertinent research I've come across in the past year, and I've been doing a ton of it, and I have friends who send me articles all the time and things and research, you know, and I go right to the source. I really don't cite many journalistic articles. There's only a couple because they were really good. But the rest, I have 150 references from high-quality sources, and I make it very condensed, you know, why masks don't work, why they're not necessary, and why they are dangerous. So I really encourage people, you know, I understand people are busy. I get that. And I understand that rooting through all the different sources of information and weighing them and find, you know, it took a lot of time. You know, luckily I enjoy doing that. And it actually helped me get through this year, greatly helped me. And so this has been healing for me. It's gotten me through this to put this all out there. You know, I made it easy. Super easy. I explain, you know, the media literacy aspect, and I tie it back into tobacco. And we all know that when tobacco was being promoted in the early 1900s, doctors were telling you it was safe. There were even scientific studies and university studies, you know, saying that it's safe, it doesn't harm you, and they listed all these benefits, you know, weight loss, helps you relax, and the party line, the drumbeat, like you called it, Tonio, was smoke, smoke, smoke. You know, everybody was doing it. And you had to go to work and be around a room full of people smoking. And it's still the leading cause of death. And now here we are, 100 years later, and instead of picking up cigarettes, people are still going to get negative health results from wearing masks. I mean, it's not tar, but you are causing, you know, oxygen deprivation. You are breathing back in dangerous types of bacteria. Dr. Fauci's own research says that, you know, bacterial pneumonia was probably the biggest killer during the Spanish flu. Well, what's one of the leading causes of bacterial pneumonia? Breathing back in, you know, that bacteria, having it grow in your mouth, which I also have a little section address, mask mouth, they call it. It's becoming prevalent. And so what's going to happen when we breathe that bacteria back in? And sure enough, people are getting sick now. And what are we going to blame these sicknesses on? If we're not actually looking at the data and the research, this could all be used to cause more mask use. And I'm just trying my best to stop it.
So for people who are courageous enough to open up their mind and seeing a different perspective than what they're hearing from mainstream continually, where can they find this information?
Yeah, very easily at vtmasksurvey.com. Or you could Google it. It does come up if you Google a Vermont mask survey. You might get other things too, but you will get the vtmasksurvey.com. And right on the first page that opens is the final report. And you can download it or you can read it right there on the page. It's a PDF. And people can email me any questions, any research you want to share. I am always gathering and learning. And so my email is vtmasksurvey@mail.com. So that's the email address. And on my website, too, I have, you know, that cheat sheet of the CDC, you know, references. You know, I have a whole discussion of why masks, you know, how effective are they. I also, you know, address those so-called studies, the choir study and the restaurant study, as people call them. I address all kinds of it. There's a lot of other information on there. And not that you should believe everything you read. I mean, that was one of the first things I learned. I remember Alicia Fox was my advisor one semester at Goddard. And I remember I was, you know, I was like a second year Goddard student, and I'm studying community health, and I'm reading all these great books on, you know, energy and the body and all of this stuff. And Alicia said, Amy, you're just believing everything. You're just regurgitating. You're just, you know, writing papers that just as if you believe everything you've read. And I thought that's what I was supposed to do. And I was like, wow, yeah, I guess you're right. And then how do you find out what's true? Or you know, as close as we can come. We have to discern. And so how do we tell what's true? And how do we weigh these things? You know, and that's something I've been really focused on. So I'm happy to share the results of my year-long research into that. And I think it's really relevant and important that people take some time and read it. And it's superstition. You believe in things that you don't understand, right?
Yep.
The invisible things. And these masks have become sort of like a superstitious talisman or something. Like they're going to just magically, you know, keep you healthy or safe. You know, the things people have attached to them. I mean, these are psychological, you know, programs. I mean, is what they are.
And also, we pride ourselves on being a literate society. However, I think we have become media illiterate and becoming more so all the time.
Yes, and yes, more and more and more every day. And then the kids especially, because they aren't learning it, and they've got these devices talking, you know, right in their hands, and pretty soon, you know, probably in their heads or on their glasses or somehow even further inside their bodies. I mean, it'll just be a feed that mm-hmm. you're, you know, is this really, really where
right.
we want to go?
Right. Like we've evolved to live within nature as part of the natural world. And now we're moving towards this techno world, this techno vision of life, and they talk about transhumanism, and it's happening very quickly. I think it's happening much too fast for us to adapt to it. I mean, look at the way we're adapting to the inundation of information through the internet. I mean, we can't handle it. We don't know how to filter it. We don't know how to think critically about it. We don't know how to respond to it. We don't know how to exist within this new environment that's expanding exponentially into dimensions that never existed before.
Right, and even our journalists, you know, who are supposed to help us with that, you know, and do the tedious work like what I did, you know, do the digging, find out, fact check, you know, they're relying on fact checkers now. I mean,
many of them, it seems like most of them, are just as media illiterate as the rest of us.
Yes. And so where, you know, and there has been, if you've been paying attention to, you know, the turnover in journalism, that's been systematic, you know, cutting these positions, cutting this funding, less local coverage, you know, less journalists, boots on the ground, and it's become more about, you know, looking good and reading the prompter, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a show. It's
being
a
mouthpiece.
What's that? I'm sorry.
Being a mouthpiece.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and they're, you know, but every day more and more of them, any that are left, you know, that still, you know, have any courage are stepping up. I mean, they are, and where we're all going to end up, you know, we're all going to end up outside of that world, and that's fine with me. And I actually, a lot of people call it, you know, the dinosaur media. There are a lot more people every day who are just turning away from it and seeing it for the two-dimensional story it is. So what would I love to do? I'd love to, just what I'm doing, you know, teach people, you know, of all ages, you know, not only how to survive in this beautiful planet, you know, and take care of ourselves, but also how to discern, you know, and sift through information and understand the basic laws, and, you know, together. Let's explore that together. Let's get back, you know, to where we belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And I hope that you get back into teaching the kids again.
Oh, me too. I miss playing. I really do. Grown-ups don't like to play as much. You know, they won't stop everything
right,
and go.
Right, playing with the kids. I mean, yeah, I totally agree. Kids are so much more fun than adults.
Yeah. Yeah, and honest and in touch. You know, they actually do.
Genuine.
Still remember.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, genuine, absolutely.
Genuine, authentic human beings.
Yes.
As opposed to these so-called adults who have just become basically like sheeple.
I know, and we're going to have to find, you know, there's a lot of encouragement on both sides of this issue, on wherever you're looking at it from, to fear and dislike people who don't agree. You know, it's happening on both sides. You know, there's actually, I don't know if you've heard of this fear of shedding that's going on. Have you heard of that, Tonio?
You mean from
the
vaccines,
or so-called?
I've heard all sorts of things.
Yeah, and so, you know, so there's actually, you know, now that people, you know, some folks are willing to take off their masks and walk freely and breathe again, you know, there are other people who are afraid to be around them because they got their vaccine and they're afraid of catching something from them. And to me, that just feels like it's the same party line. It's the same story. They're just recycling it now on the other side. And so we've been divided, and, you know, on purpose. And I had to sift through a lot of stuff. I mean, there is a lot of information out there, you know, that's just not accurate, not valid, you know, like this shedding thing. I know it's got a lot of people scared, but I can't find any real evidence.
Well, it's all about fear. And
yes.
Divide and conquer is, fear is the main element in any political strategy.
So what do I do is I kind of go back to the laws of nature. You know, is it likely? You know, what other things have been shed? And what other things, like you said, is there enough in the air possibly from a person without symptoms under any circumstances, you know, to make someone else sick? You know,
right.
That is so...
But that takes rational thinking, and
right.
You can't do that when you're afraid. And our culture has been trained to be afraid, to live in fear of everything. And
yeah.
And more things to be afraid of are being created all the time. And through our online culture, fear and polarization and animosity and hatred and division are being cultivated.
And it's so sad because we have never before lived at a time when there was more possibility and potential for safety and acceptance. You know, we've come so far on issues of abuse and, you know, and all these issues. We've come so far on this stuff,
and
even as far as our immune systems. And it's because of world travel and because we are always mingling with so many people that we are not likely to have a major pandemic. Like, it's just not likely.
Well, I think that's the nature of living in this world, is that we don't get a free, easy ride, a one-sided, easy ride. We have to deal with the complexity of dynamic tension. And that means whatever is good, we also have to wrestle with the other end of that spectrum.
That's true.
And it manifests continually. And as we are making amazing strides in wonderful ways in so many areas of life, but at the same time, that is bringing up so much shit, so much of the stuff on the other end of the spectrum. And I think that may be a fundamental aspect of the way the world works, and that we just have to realize that and recognize it as that.
I think you just defined, one of the main laws of nature. You know, that,
yeah,
that,
exactly.
And I've been thinking about that too through all this.
I hesitated to use the word law, but I think you're right that it is a fundamental law of reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you can't have one, you cannot have quote unquote good without the other side. You can't escape the full spectrum of reality, of experience, of of anything.
Right. I remember when I was a Goddard student, I went to Findhorn. I went over to Scotland, and I visited intentional communities and traveled around. And Findhorn was really cool, and of course. I mean, it was really, really great talking to fairies and everything. But I remember having this kind of feeling like that there's an ignoring of the darkness here. You know, it's so New Agey and light and all this. You know, but where is that darkness? You know, I know it's here somewhere. You know, and it is, of course. It's always going to be. so that it is something we, you know, feel it, that we have to purge that darkness, you know, to get to the light. And there is no perfection, but we certainly can aim in one direction or the other and influence that. We are co-creators. And if we work with the laws, I mean, that's where my hope comes, is that all of these things, like suffocating people, that goes against the laws of nature. I mean, of, you know, that's going to have to give. And that's where my courage to speak out was, because at some point, I mean, it might take 100 years. I don't know how long it's going to take, but people are going to have to acknowledge just the facts of the matter, you know, that this is not healthy, and it's doing harm. And unfortunately, harm is being done every day as we go along, and it's not addressed. You know, I can't help that. That's not in my control. But I can try my best to speed up the learning process so we can get there from here as quickly as possible.
Well, as you said earlier, need is the mother of invention. And if we get stifled or strangled, or what emerges out of that is the impulse to breathe again.
Yes.
So, again, there's this dynamic tension between the different ends of the spectrum. And again, I don't think there's any escape from any of it, that we just have to learn to live with all of it, to embrace it all, that we can't reject one side for the other, that the only way to actually experience the side that we want is to fully accept the other side as well. And that, I think a lot of people talk about how it's only by experiencing and embracing the suffering that we've gone through that we can really appreciate and experience joy.
Yeah, and that's healing, right?
Yeah. And and the essence of healing in that way is embracing all of it as a wholeness, and recognizing that they're not separate. Good and bad are not separate. You can't exclude the quote-unquote bad. That
right.
There's so much to learn from the quote-unquote bad, or from our mistakes, or from these things. But if we perceive mistakes and bad, quote-unquote bad, or quote-unquote evil, as something to push away and not avail ourselves of the lessons or the wisdom that we can gain from it, then we miss out. And we'll also miss out on all the goodness that arises out of it.
Right.
And healing and integration, which I think is what life is all about. It's learning to integrate all of it without rejecting any of it. We can make choices about which direction we want to go in as we learn.
Yeah, I wrote that down, healing and integration. I'm going to make that a key point moving forward. I mean, a lot of this for me has been, you know, just like teaching, I love it in a way. It's a super challenge, is to figure out how to make information accessible, you know, to people, and to get around their resistance or their, you know, the fixed mindset they already have about that subject, you know, and expose them to just some more information, you know. And so healing and integration, I invite people to join me in healing, you know, healing all the wounds, you know, that we've been through here, and try to, you know, integrate other points of view, you know, the silencing that has been done to me personally, you know, by close people. It's just it's mind-boggling. I really hope that people can come back to healing and hear something. I really hope people can look at this report. You know, it's broken up into many sections. It's got a table of contents. You can just open to whatever you're interested in and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, give the website again for people to find this information.
Yep, it's the Vermont Mask Survey, and it can be found at vtmasksurvey.com.
Well, it's been fun talking with you. I mean, we've really gone deep into a lot of things around all of this.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you.
I'm just so grateful, Tonio. This is just so great.
Thank you for having the courage to really stick your neck out and do this.
Yeah, well, no, you too. I mean, I'm just encouraged by all the people who do speak up for the children and everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, thank you. Happy summer.
Yes, happy summer. And I'm wishing you a speedy return to your kids.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hoping too. Yeah, I'm worried. I don't know what kind of condition anybody's in right now. You know, I haven't really seen anybody for over a year and how they're handling all this. I don't know. You know, it's something they don't talk about in the media or anything much.
Well, when you get back into the classroom, I'm sure you'll be having a lot of these conversations with them about this.
Yeah.
That's what I would do if I was a teacher.
Yeah, have conversations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The hell with all this STEM crap, because there's so much more to life and learning than just STEM. There's plenty of room for STEM, but we got to make room for real life and the real issues that kids are dealing with and that they need to really grow into full human beings.
Right. Yeah, that's why the last 2 days of school that I had with them, you know, we had come back on that Monday and Tuesday, but we knew we were closing school on Wednesday, and the 6-foot rule wasn't in place yet and all that. So I put my tables together, a couple of tables, so it was a nice, like, family-style table, you know, and my classes were small because a lot of parents weren't sending kids, you know, and we sat around those little tables and talked, you know, and I just felt like that was the most important thing, was what's on your mind, what are you thinking, what questions do you have, you know.
And what are you feeling?
And yeah, exactly, and do you feel your classmates around you? You know, and do you feel our love and support? Because it was so scary.
And
they were going home to home. Oh, Tonio, I can't even tell you. For me to even think about it, it's so sad.
Mm-hmm. And also to talk about, you know, the fears and discomfort that's arising in them.
Yeah.
And to feel safe enough to really talk about that.
Yeah, and it was hard, you know, because even me, I was going through like a, wait a minute, what the heck is going on? You know, it didn't make any sense to me. So I'm in my own, you know, reeling, you know, but I just knew that that's what I had to do. I was like, we just have to be, I don't know how long it's going to be until we can do this again. And guess what? It's now been over a year that they have not been able to sit that close and speak freely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're really isolated, worse than any other you know, except maybe elders and nursing homes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We are, it's bad what we're doing to people. This is really bad.
Well, may we all be able to speak freely about anything.
Yeah. Well, thank you for keeping the airwaves free, at least this little corner of the airwaves, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess it's the least I can do.
No, it is the key. It's part of, I'm sure, the biggest thing you're here to do. I mean, I don't know what else you do in your life, but from what I know of your life, which is your radio show, I think it's huge. It's huge.
Hmm. It is a big part of my life at this point.
Well, good. Good. It's worthy. It is. Yeah, of that.
Well, thank you. And yeah, so my guest has been Amy Hornblass. She is a teacher, a health educator, and the author of this VT Mask Survey. And Amy, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tonio. Have fun.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.